everybody. Welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you live every day. The number one HR show on the radio, internet radio, that is. So, want to get to our guest, first time on, and knows so much about HR, and that is probably the understatement of the week. So, would love to introduce and welcome Cornelia Gamlin. Welcome to Drive Through HR.
Thank you very much, Brian. Pleasure to be here.
Well, if you would, first time on the show, so if you would introduce yourself to our listeners, and then we'll roll into our big question after that.
Okay. As Brian said, my name is Cornelia Gamlin. I have been in HR, as I like to say, since God was a girl, and that means I've been doing this for a very, very long time. Hey, I always hate to admit the number of years, but it has certainly been a very exciting profession, and I think what I like seeing is the kind of the ebbs and flows of what's gone on. I started my career with a small manufacturing firm in California and then moved into a larger IT professional services firm. And after working there for a couple of years, I had an opportunity to come back to the East Coast and stay with the same company where I really was focused a little bit more on corporate initiatives and making sure that we were compliant with a lot of what was going on at the time. So that gave me the opportunity to really kind of wander around Washington a little bit and have an opportunity to work with some of the influencers in developing some public policy. And after I did that for about another 10 years, I decided, corporate world is great, and it's opened up a lot of doors for me. I was able to get very involved in the Society for Human Resource Management and decided it's time to do something different. So I kind of spun off and went out on my own 13 years ago and have been an independent consultant for the past 13 years and still continue to stay involved with SHRM. And 2 years ago, a co-author and I, a colleague, wrote a book called The Big Book of HR. So I'm feeling like I'm now morphing into something yet a little bit different, but still being able to stay very tightly connected to the field of human resources.
Well, you definitely put a little bit of a shelf life on you right there. Anybody that spells out Big Sherm? sort of shows your hold card. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
So, but that's all right. That's all right. When God was a girl, that is hilarious. I might use that later this afternoon in conversation. That's awesome. So, well, what currently? And first of all, appreciate the long term dedication to the profession and being a professional. That just is, and getting your certification. I mean, just all of that. The whole package. So I would love to hear what's top of mind keeping you up at night in HR.
Well, there are so many issues right now. I think we're in a very, very robust time. We're seeing the impact of globalization on organizations and HR professionals needing to stay up with that. The changes that are being brought about by technology, we talk a lot about that in the Big Book of HR, but we see it as much. And in fact, we're being impacted by it as we're getting pulled into it more and more to understand, how do we promote ourselves? How do we promote our book? How do we promote our services? And then trying to kind of wrap your mind about, what is the HR professional needing to understand as they're out there, it's in their own organizations, and being able to stay up with technology and all of the issues that technology touches. Those are, some of the things that I spend a lot of time thinking about. But probably because of the nature of the work that I do, I spend a lot of time working with companies around issues of EEO and affirmative action. That's where a lot of my work has been in my HR career. And I've just seen so many changes. You know, when I talk about the ebbs and flows, there's been so much that's happened and changed. And, you know, right now we're seeing a new Secretary of Labor come in, and a lot of things have been on hold with the Department of Labor because they were kind of in between leadership. But now I think we're all sort of sitting back, taking a deep breath and saying more is going to happen. We can expect to see more coming down the pike. We have an administration that is very, very supportive of workers and making sure that employees are getting their, you know, getting a fair shake from their employers. And then, you know, you couple that with the state of the economy and you know, as we're trying to pull out of this recession that we've been in, there's just more focus on, are we treating people fairly? Are we treating people appropriately? Are we making sure that people aren't being discriminated against?
Well, and so where do you think, for example, we have a lot of listeners that range from really small companies that do
mm-hmm.
everything, obviously to the large companies that are more segmented in kind of what their role focuses on. So
mm-hmm.
let's start with big companies, people that are actually focused in on and have, you know, have their hands on anything around the, you know, anything that touches EEO per se.
Okay.
Where do they need to be focused in? So let's start there and kind of end up with like the really small, you know, company that maybe isn't even thinking about that at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
That need to be. So big company first. What's kind of a top of list type thought?
I think one of the things that's probably on the top of the list for most large companies is the impact of the Supreme Court decision on DOMA, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act. A lot of people obviously are stopping to ask, how is this going to affect my employee benefits packages? Do I have to, if I'm in a state that recognizes same-sex marriage, I'm going to have to extend spousal benefits. But I think a lot of larger companies are also asking, if we're not currently extending benefits to somebody who's in a different type of an arrangement, like a civil union, or just somebody who has a domestic partner, whether or not it's been legally recognized in any form or not, is this something that we want to be doing? Is this something that we can afford to be doing? And so I think that's going to be a big issue for larger companies. They, of course, have the resources to be able to take that step back and say, what is this going to mean for us? You know, what's the financial impact for it? But I think on the other hand, for a smaller company, they may be struggling as they're looking at things like healthcare costs and saying, you know, all right, I will go ahead and we'll extend these benefits if we're in a state where the law recognizes same-sex marriage and we've got to treat them equally as we do any other married couple. But they may stop and really have to make a determination, can we afford to extend this to a domestic partner if we're not required by law to do that? And I think, you know, that starts to get into the value proposition of the company, the economic conditions. You know, is this something that we can afford to do? Looking at some kind of projections, if we go ahead and extend these benefits, what do we anticipate the cost is going to be? How many employees are going to have their partners that will actually sign up for these benefits? Or how many of them are in relationships where both partners are working, so both partners may have the opportunity to get benefits through their employers.
Well, and then so, and those are definitely, and that's something right now that I think everybody's trying to sort out
mm-hmm.
because there's, I mean, it's literally like, okay, where do we even start?
Exactly.
Now that there's precedent, obviously, and opinions, and I think it became real really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably a lot of probably legal billing that is happening at the moment, just doing discovery on where
absolutely
we start.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then you couple that with an issue that I'm not even going to attempt to talk about, but what's the impact of the Affordable Health Care Act or the Affordable Care Act? Because I am not a benefits expert. It's one area of HR that I've stayed far away from. But you know that those conversations are going on as well, or in tandem with these other issues around same-sex marriage. So it's a big challenge, and I think for the smaller organizations, they really need to be getting good legal advice around these issues, and then good practical advice from their benefits brokers, because these areas have gotten so specialized within HR, and even in a smaller company, if you've got a good HR generalist manager or a good HR generalist director, there's still just so much to be that you've got to grasp and have an in-depth understanding of, that it's really important that you're getting good support and that you know where to go and get really good advice on a lot of these issues. One of the other things that I see, particularly for companies that are doing business with the federal government, and I happen to be in the Washington, D.C. area still, so I've got a lot of clients in that space, and there are a lot of government contractors here, is the focus from the Department of Labor on veterans and the disabled. The DOL has had these regulations pending for quite some time, and they have finally put out a call for approval for final regulations for government contractors around their practices for hiring veterans and hiring the disabled. We've had those requirements for many, many years, but this is the first time in a long time that they've really looked at it with a different eye. And I think it's going to be a rude awakening for a lot of government contractors, particularly the smaller ones, because the expectation of what the Department of Labor wants from employers has really increased. They're really expecting that they do a lot more with respect to outreach to try to bring more of the returning veterans into the workforce. They're going to be looking for a lot more documentation from contractors to show what their efforts are. And that's where these companies really need to start to realize that they've got to put some more time and effort into not just what they're doing, but the proof around what they're doing, to assure that they've got the good track record and they can prove that they've got this good track record for veterans and disabled hiring. So I think that, you know, for anybody who may be listening, who is a government contractor, it's yet another area that is going to continue to be an area of focus on and something that we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to in the coming years.
Well, and that's and that's what I've heard from just in conversations with a couple of people, that the kind of, to go back a little bit to one of your comments, the pending legislation and kind of how it's rolling out and when it's rolling out has everybody in a complete uproar for obvious reasons. Complexities of it is overwhelming, and small to large. I mean, it doesn't really, it's just a bigger scale, but it is such a weight, so to speak, on daily operations.
It is, in my opinion, of course. Yeah, I mean, the advantage that a lot of the larger companies have is there are services out there that they can take advantage of that can help them with some of these obligations. But the services have a cost to them. And, you know, when I sit down with some smaller companies and tell them, you know, you're going to have to find some internal resources to do this, because I know you can't afford to go to one of these services and pay, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a year. I know the size of their organization, and they just don't have that in their budget. So they're going to have to find a way to be able to to make sure that they're meeting these obligations in a way that the government expects them to be meeting them. And, you know, the only thing that concerns me sometimes is, are we putting so much effort into some of the paperwork effort that's behind the scenes to make sure that we're documenting anything? And at the end of the day, what's the end result going to be? Is it going to be that we get more veterans and disabled into the workforce, or is it just that we now have a paper trail that shows, well, we tried a whole bunch of things and it didn't yield quite the, you know, the degree of success that perhaps we had hoped for?
That's great. Well, I'm going to do a quick reset, everybody. You're listening to Drive Through HR, and this is Brian and Misha with our wonderful guest, Cornelia Gamblam. Well, Cornelia, in the beginning you talked about the impact of globalization, and then now you moved on to, you know, the paperwork efforts and all. So I want to switch the gear a little bit and talk about when we bring a lot of diverse workforce across the world, what's the impact of this background screening, or what are some confusions among these business owners have in terms of the latest EEOC guidance on the use of probably criminal background checks or the background checks and screening?
I think that's an area that a lot of companies are confused about. I would agree with you, Nisha. The best advice that I would provide is, when you're thinking about doing background checks, and this is almost for any kind of a reference check, is make sure that there's a link between what the duties of the job are and the nature of the information that you're gathering. So you always want to make sure that you can show the relevance to the job, and that there's some kind of compatibility there. You know, and the example, so some of the obvious examples is if you're hiring somebody to work with children, obviously you want to do a background check to make sure that the individual isn't a sex offender. But if it's somebody that's going to be picking up trash, and not having it, really having any interaction with other people, for instance, and I know that's an exaggeration, you know, is the nature of the information that you're getting in the background check relevant to what the individual is going to be doing? I think there's a big concern from the EEOC that people are running these background checks just as a way to say, we can screen out certain portions of the population, and some of those portions may happen to be higher minority portions of the population. But you take that step back and say, is it really relevant? Is the nature of the information really relevant? You know, we've gone through the same thing with credit checks in the past. It's important if you're you know, you're hiring somebody and they're going to be handling money, and they're in a position of some level of responsibility that has to do with the organization's finances, then their credit background, you know, may be very, very important in a situation like that. But again, if it's somebody who's in a position in the organization where they're not going to be around any money, maybe they've just, you know, gotten into some bad situations personally in their life and their credit has suffered, but it really doesn't have any impact on their ability to do their job. So, you know, companies have to be aware of, you know, what they're doing, why they're doing it, and, you know, and again, there's a cost to doing background checks. So I think, you know, from a business perspective, the first question you want to ask is it going to give me any useful information? And, you know, what's the return on my investment at the end of the day? Or am I just throwing money out the window, you know, to get this information that really isn't going to be helpful to me in making a good hiring decision?
Well, as you talked about that, I have this question in my mind. Well, what are some best practices that you can suggest to these employers to probably train their managers or hiring officials or the decision maker about the, you know, the laws and regulations, and to not to have any prohibition on employment discrimination? I mean, it's prohibition on employment discrimination, I'm sorry.
I think it kind of goes back to some very, very basic issues, which are understanding, you know, what the job is. You know, what is it that we're hiring for? What are the skills that we need? What are the competencies that we need? And then everything that you do in your job search from there really has to align with what the basic needs are for the position that you're hiring for. So, you know, I mean, that starts with your search. It goes right into the interview situation and, you know, kind of back to the things we used to talk about many, many years ago about the kinds of questions that you can ask in a job interview. And, you know, I think what's happened is as we've evolved, we've gotten past that, and people say, okay, I know there are the certain forbidden questions. You know, I can't ask people certain things, but oh, I'm curious, so maybe I can get to that information in other ways. And I think that's why we've started to see some of the proliferation of background checks kind of popping up. But if you can always go back to that baseline of, here's the job. This is what I need for a position. You know, I'm hiring for a financial analyst. So what are the things that are key? What are the things that are relevant? And what's the relevant information that I need to get in order to make the best hiring decision? And if I'm going after information, you know, in a background check or through a credit check or something like that, and it really has no relevancy to the position that I'm hiring for, then I really ought not be chasing down that information. It's, you know, and again, it gets back to the value proposition of the business. I'm wasting resources. I'm wasting somebody's time, whether it's a hiring manager or human resources time, or I'm wasting financial resources if I'm outsourcing some of those kinds of reviews and background checks.
Well, and And kind of continue on this kind of the screening, hiring, that side of the employment lifecycle. Let's talk a little bit about the technology space. You spent a year or two in there, and so when you're in a niche or a vertical that is so out of whack, so to speak, from kind of just think of from a scarcity side or from the economic side, where there's just no way to ever meet the talent. Like in 20 years, we're never going to meet the demand. Mm-hmm. And so, how does that start affecting from policy to practice process? How does that start affecting on kind of a macro level what people are doing when there's nobody out there? You can't manufacture them quick enough.
I think that's where companies are starting to get very creative with their employee development needs. You know, the struggle is always, yes, I want to find the perfect talent, and I, you know, as we're seeing, you're never going to find the perfect person for every job that you have in your organization. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you settle for less, which I think some people think they have to do, but you find somebody who maybe is, and I'm just throwing out some numbers here, but maybe has 80% of what it is that you need, or even 50% of what you need. But they're really strong in what their base is. And then you've got to ask yourself, well, what can I do to develop them to, you know, to either get them up to speed or to develop them to be able to move into a more responsible role in the future. So I think employee development, not only is it a wonderful way to retain your talent, but it's a great way to make sure that you can invest in people and hold on to them and give you the exact skills that you need that, you know, that they can almost be customized for your individual organization. I think if companies are paying more attention to that and even developing the resources internally and the training programs internally or the development programs internally, that will help them to bring these people along. The other thing that I think smart companies need to be doing is thinking about employees who are getting ready to retire and what can we do to retain their knowledge and perhaps even retain them in some fashion within the organization. I've said for a long time, being a member of the baby boomer generation, that our generation is really going to reinvent, and now we are reinventing what retirement looks like. It doesn't look anything like what our parents did. And I think there are a lot of boomers who even boomers want to stay in the workforce, some of them for reasons, you know, that are economic, but others are sitting there saying, I'm looking at 65, which is, you know, this so-called traditional retirement age, and I'm not ready to just, you know, shut the lights off, walk out of the office, and stop producing anything. But I think there's also a realization that I want to continue working, but I maybe want to work in a different fashion. So I think companies have a great opportunity to start looking at different ways to retain the people and their knowledge within the organization, but to be a little bit more flexible in how they retain that talent and that knowledge for their organization. The more flexible they're willing to be, I think the more the employees who are getting ready to retire will be willing to hang around and say, yeah, you know what, I'll work for 3 months out of the year, or I'll work 3 days a week. And I can help to train some and bring some new people along, because I know I don't want to be here a whole lot longer, but you can convince me to stay for a little while, and let me help to share some of the things that I've learned along the way with some of the newer entrants into the workforce. I think that can be a win-win situation for everybody.
Well, and do you actually, we got about 2 minutes and 45 seconds, and so one last question.
Sure.
Do you think, like, again, when you have these verticals that are just the scarcity level of talent, it just changes how you approach everything with it. Do you think that's going to affect how you put together your teams in HR to handle that level of scarcity?
Absolutely, because, I mean, as we see the workers and the type of work becoming so narrow and so scarce, you're going to have HR professionals who understand that and really be working shoulder to shoulder with the executives and with the line managers to understand what their needs are. And to have some creativity around how are we going to get the talent, how are we going to retain the talent. So I think it's a big challenge for HR people to recognize that I've got to go into this not just looking at it and saying this is how we've always done things, but I've got to be really, really creative to be able to meet their needs. And, of course, at the same time, be balancing that against all of the external pressures you have, like the regulatory environment, like the legal environment, to say, all right, if we kind of want to step out of the box and take the giant step out of the box, we have to make sure we're still within, you know, within the lines that the regulatory environment and the legal environment have drawn for us.
Well, and that is a perfect way to wrap things up, and thank you so much for coming on the show today. Where can people connect up with you?
They can visit me in two different places, preferably at the website www.bigbookofhr, and we are also on Twitter at @BigBookOfHR, and you can find us on Facebook as well. That's probably the easiest way to find us these days in the virtual world.
Well, Cornelia, thank you so much. Nisha, always a pleasure. We're out of here, folks. We'll talk to you tomorrow.